Good morning.
Good morning.
Everyone enjoying their breakfast here. My name is Jeffrey Blankford, and I'd like to welcome you here on behalf of IRMEP's Mordechai Vanunu Open Nuclear Dialogue Initiative. It's on the conference on Israel's nuclear arsenal, espionage, capacity, and future. I call this historic because even to publicly acknowledge that Israel has developed and been sitting on several hundred nuclear weapons for the past two or three decades is something that no sitting president or member of Congress has ever summoned the courage to acknowledge. And that includes, unfortunately, President Obama. This silence persists even while the President and Congress have just added additional sanctions against Iran to those already existing, clearly intended to bring Tehran's economy to a standstill. And for what? For perhaps, but not for sure, building a nuclear weapon that Israel developed through deception and theft and whose existence it has refused to admit for the past 40 years. This silence persisted during the May 2010 review conference of the Treaty of Nonproliferation of Nuclear Weapons held at the UN headquarters in May 2010, at which the Obama administration agreed only to discuss making the Middle East nuclear free zone at the next review conference, 2002. Now, yesterday, the President welcomed Prime Minister Netanyahu, what was described by Dana Milbank in today's Washington Post as a surrender to Israel. And this is what Obama said yesterday in his meeting with Netanyahu. Quote, "Finally, we discussed issues that arose out of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Conference. And I reiterated to the Prime Minister that there is no change in U.S. policy when it comes to these issues. We strongly believe that given its size, its history, the region that it's in, and the threats that are leveled against us, against it, that Israel has unique security requirements. It's got to be able to respond to threats of any combination of threats in the region. And that's why we remain unwavering in our commitment to Israel's security. And the United States will never ask Israel to take any steps that would undermine their security interests." The wall of silence from the White House and Congress has long been attributed to an unwritten agreement made between President Richard Nixon and Prime Minister Golda Meir back in December 1969, never formally announced, in which Washington agreed not to comment on Israel's nuclear weapons program as long as Israel did not openly test weapons or declare or acknowledge their existence. The criteria was that was the basis for the strategic ambiguity of not introducing nuclear weapons to the region. A more likely reason is that had the United States acknowledged that Israel had nuclear weapons, that would have required under U.S. law the freezing of all aid to Israel. And we know that's not going to happen. That Congress has also observed this agreement, to which it was not a party, is an indication that there are larger forces at work here, and you'll hear more about them from today's speakers. And this leads to a question sometimes asked partly in jest, which is the more important occupied territory for Israel, Washington or the West Bank? You probably have a better understanding of that before you leave than you do now if you don't already have come to a conclusion on that. The same code of congressional silence that keeps our representatives mum about Israel's nuclear arsenal is also enforced in the case of Israeli whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu, in whose honor today's event is being staged. Mordechai Vanunu, you may recall, had worked for nearly 10 years, from 1976 to 1985, as a technician at the Negev Nuclear Research Center near Dimona in southern Israel. After converting to Christianity in the early 80s, he became increasingly troubled by the nature of his work and concluded that the building of weapons of mass destruction was morally wrong. He left the Dimona Center in Israel to travel around the world, but not before taking photographs of what he saw while working at Israel's nuclear weapons factory. These photographs would later appear in the London Sunday Times after he ran into a Times reporter who he met in Australia. The Israeli response might have been predictable. Venuto was lured to Rome by a beautiful Mossad agent, where he was drugged, kidnapped, and smuggled back to Israel. In a trial that was held behind closed doors, he was sentenced to 18 years, the first 11 of which he served in solitary confinement. Venuto was finally released in April 2004, but was forbidden to travel outside Israel to meet with foreign journalists or foreign nationals of any sort, or own any kind of communications equipment, from a computer to a cell phone. I was fortunate enough to be in Jerusalem in 2004 to spend a morning with Venuto, and I found him a wonderful, warm human being. He was the man who Daniel Ellsberg, whistleblower of some note, referred to as the preeminent hero of the nuclear era. Venuto has since been sent back to prison several times for speaking with foreign journalists. At this very moment, he is again in an Israeli prison for the very same reason. On May 12th, 11 days before his current sentence was announced, Amnesty International issued a press release which said, quote, "If Mordechai Vanunu is imprisoned again, Amnesty International will declare him to be a prisoner of conscience and call for his immediate and unconditional release," end quote. On June 18th, it did just that. I was unable to find a single mainstream U.S. publication that published the Amnesty Report International statement. And as I said earlier, there are larger forces at work here. A moment ago I mentioned at the U.S. Congress, which has a long history of holding the fate of Israeli prisoners near and dear to its heart, has made an exception in Vanunu's case. I bring this up because at the end of June, both houses of Congress, passed by unanimous consent resolutions calling on Hamas to release an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, who was captured 4 years ago on the Israeli border with Gaza and while manning a battle station which regularly shelled the people of besieged Gaza. You may also not be surprised to learn that Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, from my way in California, brags about carrying a copy of the dog tags of Gilad Shalit with her wherever she goes. I can't think of a better symbol for the state of affairs in Washington than that. It's been this way for many years, and unfortunately, it's likely to continue to be that way unless we do something about it. It is more than appropriate, by the way, that this event is being held in the International Spy Museum. Since much of what you're going to hear today deals with deliberate deception practiced by the state of Israel regarding its nuclear program that had far more serious implications to the United States than ordinary espionage, although there is some of that involved as well. On your way in, you may have noticed the glass wall of declassified documents released under the Freedom of Information Act. But many documents that should populate that wall are missing, since the CIA and FBI continue to cover up information dealing with U.S.-Israel nuclear dealings. I can speak from personal experience as an espionage target, having been one of some 10,000 individuals and a member of more than one of some 600 organizations in Northern California alone that were spied on by a man named Erwin Sewell, who is the late head of the Intelligence Department of the Anti-Defamation League, referred to as, quote, my chief fact finder. Now, it's a matter of public knowledge, but not widely known, that an investigation by the FBI and the San Francisco Police Department in the early 90s revealed that the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, or formerly part of B'nai B'rith, had been conducting for some years a massive spying operation on individuals and organizations throughout the United States. While a portion of these activities were devoted to exposing the activities of skinheads and neo-Nazi groups that operated at the margins of society, the major focus of that chief fact finder, a man by the name of Roy Bullock, were Palestinian Arab American groups and anti-apartheid activists connected to the African National Congress including black South African exiles residing in the United States or traveling here. Most of the spied-on individuals and organizations fell into a section that Bullock labeled PINKO groups. These included such organizations as the NAACP, the Asian Law Caucus, Irish Northern Aid, the American Civil Liberties Union, 20 labor unions, and Labor Committee on the Middle East, of which I was a co-founder. Bullock, who I had met after he had infiltrated the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, was one of the early people signing up for our Labor Committee on the Middle East and attended our early meetings. As it turned out, he was spying on the anti-apartheid organizations, but he was not just doing it for the Anti-Defamation League. Bullock, the investigation revealed, was also being paid for providing information to agents for South African intelligence based in the San Francisco Bay Area after being recruited for the job by a San Francisco cop buddy of his. Spying for South Africa required no greater effort on Bullock's part because, as he admitted during a deposition, he was already doing that for the Anti-Defamation League. And I was also an anti-apartheid activist myself, so I counted both as a pro-Palestinian activist as an anti-apartheid activist, both counts. During the 30 years Bullock had been working for the ADL, and up to his arrest and exposure, he had been paid through a cutout in Beverly Hills, a lawyer named Bruce Hochman, who was a former head of the Los Angeles Jewish Federation. When, rather than firing Bullock, when it was revealed he had been working for South Africa, or offering apology for his spying, the ADL put him directly on his pay, on their payroll. Several class action lawsuits were brought against the ADL, but only one had a measure of success. It was filed by former Congressman Pete McCloskey on behalf of those who had been targeted by Bullock for their work against both Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and against South African apartheid. The case was in litigation for about 10 years, and by the end there were three of us left. When all their appeals were exhausted, the ADL offered and we agreed to a settlement with a stipulation, very important stipulation, that we would not be restricted to a confidentiality agreement, which allowed me to talk about this case. In pursuit of the case, we learned the ADL would provide information on my activities and those of my two plaintiffs to the governments of Israel and South Africa. A telling moment occurred during a deposition taken by Pete McCloskey, former congressman, of former Mossad agent Victor Ostrovsky, who also exposed the lack of space, which also exposed the lack of space that exists between the Anti-Defamation League and Israeli intelligence. Ostrovsky, you may recall, published two books about his experience with the Mossad, both bestsellers, that exposed the inner workings of the Israeli spy agency. While they provided no useful information about the ADL for us, what astonished us and astonished Ostrovsky was when the lawyers of the Anti-Defamation League demanded Ostrovsky turn over to them the documents that he had taken when he had left the Mossad. Now here are the lawyers for American Jewish organizations demanding from this former Mossad agent that he give them the papers he had taken with them. Of course, he denied their request, but his request still is on the record. And if you want more evidence about the connection, I can't find a better piece of evidence. Of course, Ostrovsky, at the time you may recall, and if not, you'll learn today from one of our panelists, Sasha Polakoff-Saransky, that South Africa had become a close ally of Israel and continued to be so, even when the apartheid regime was subject to international sanctions, and not just when it came to nuclear weapons. Here, for example, is a page for the Financial Mail of South Africa, January 31st, 1986. It's a blown-up copy of the page. The bold-faced headline reads, "The Israeli Connection." The article is illustrated by a colorful hourglass with a South African flag at the top, a Star of David symbolizing Israel in the center, and an American flag on the bottom. And that's us. It was intended to illustrate how apartheid in South Africa would benefit from the Israel-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, which had been pushed by AIPAC and approved the previous December by the Reagan administration over the objections of some of America's leading corporations, such as Monsanto and Dow Chemical, which shows you the power of AIPAC and the Zionist lobby here in this country. In a large section, reads, "Many companies are grasping opportunities provided by a technology agreement between South Africa and Israel. Exporting technology to the United States through Israel is one of the many advantages under a new agreement. At the time, I sent a copy of this article to the Representative Dandy Fussell, Chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Fussell wrote to me that he was going to forward it, my letter, to Lee Hamilton and Howard Wolpe, who were the chairs of the subcommittee on Europe and the Middle East and Africa, respectively. I never heard a word back from either of them, and there was no, evidently, any follow-up on this case. A clear violation of international sanctions and U.S. law.